This week's episode of Still Untitled is brought to you by Eero. Whatever your Wi-Fi needs, Eero has the power to seamlessly blanket your home in fast, reliable Wi-Fi via Ethernet, wireless, or any combination. Simply set it on a flat surface or plug it into a wall outlet to expand coverage into any room. Not to mention, with the addition of a third 5 GHz radio, the second generation Eero is now tri-band and twice as fast as its predecessor, which lets you do more in every room of your home simultaneously. And with the addition of a new Thread radio, Eero can now connect to low-power devices such as locks, doorbells, and other sensors. Meanwhile, Eero Beacon is half the size, but it's even more powerful than original Eero. So whichever model you choose, with Eero's incredible customer support, you can call and get a hold of a Wi-Fi expert within 30 seconds. I have Eero plugged into several outlets in my home, which lets me use my Nintendo Switch and play multiplayer games basically anywhere, you know, even like the bathroom. So for free overnight shipping to US or Canada, visit Eero.com, that's Eero.com, select overnight as a shipping option, and use the code UNTITLED at checkout. Now on with the show.
Welcome to Still Untitled, the Adam Savage Project. I'm Will.
I'm Adam.
And I'm Norm.
Wow, you can tell exactly how long the electrons take to travel across the wires with that one, huh?
Good morning, guys.
Good morning. Hey, where are you, Adam? You look different. You look smaller.
I am in Morristown, New Jersey right now.
Woo! Shout out to Morristown, New Jersey.
Absolutely. Where?
What's so you're on tour, I assume.
I am. This is the third day of Brain Candy Live tour. We started out in Providence, Rhode Island. Last night we were in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Today it's Morristown. The crowds have been lovely. It's just starting off. Both Michael Stevens and I were a little bit shocked by how much material there was to remember. So the first rehearsal was a little bit rough, but then once we got into the tech QDQ rehearsal, it all came crashing back. So it's been very fun, like getting back on a bicycle.
So when you do the rehearsal, go ahead, Norm.
Yeah, how much rehearsal time do you have?
Well, with the crew, we spent about a full day and a half working through the bits and making sure that everyone was on the same page about them. Then we also rewrote a bunch of the show and we added in a few new bits. So those were required to figure out how they worked in the show. It was about a day and a half, and honestly, we probably could have used another day just for the technical details, but it's been going quite smoothly regardless.
And do you do that like in the first theater for the first leg of the tour, or do you?
Yeah.
Okay. You just have an extra day or two.
We show up early.
Mm-hmm. Oh, nice. That's awesome. I always kind of wondered about that. That was one of the things.
Sometimes in the past, we've also showed up in a theater that's in the same town, but a smaller rehearsal space. The first time we did Brain Candy, we were actually in a warehouse. And so we blocked out the entire show in the warehouse before we got to a theater.
So while you're in Providence, do you eat? What do you have pizza with clams on it? What's the food like in Rhode Island? I've never actually been there.
Actually, I was working so much, I only had time to have one meal at the hotel next to our venue with my lovely sister Chris.
Cobb salad.
What did I have? I think I had the beet salad.
Okay, that's a valid choice. That's a good second choice. A little feta on there. What else is going on, Norm?
This is the beginning of your tour, and you talk about you're meeting up with your sister. Are there stops along the way you've already identified, people you're going to see outside of the tour,
yeah,
or places you want to go?
Absolutely. I'm going to see my friend Sonia Pryor Jones when I'm going through one of the Ohio cities. I'm going to see Travis McElroy. I'm going to have dinner with my friend Adam Foss in Boston later on. I'm going to see my mom and my brother in Connecticut. Yeah, I'm building up stops all across the country. I'm going to see people at.
Very cool.
We got to get Travis in the city. I think I'm on an email with him, and he's going to be in SF for Sketchfest, and I feel like we have to do something with him.
Those,
sure.
Those guys are the best. They are the best.
They're totally the best, and I love Travis. I love his whole family. I saw them in New York at Comic-Con, I unfortunately will be gone the entire time Sketchfest is happening in San Francisco this year.
Oh, no.
Whoa.
I'm literally leaving before it starts, and I'm not returning until after it's over. Oh. I confirmed those dates with Janet, and this is killing me. It's the first year I haven't been part of any part of Sketchfest in like 7 or 8 years, I think.
Oh, that's a bummer.
Yeah, I know. It really sucks.
So let's see. In the past, you have brought projects to do, things to learn, all sorts of stuff to do while you're on the bus in between stops, and when you have a bunch of kind of downtime during the tour. What are you filling the days with this time? What's your strategy?
We're going to tease this a little bit bigger on Tested in the next few days, but I am about to release a product that I designed into the world. Yeah, and it goes live on Monday, and that is the building of the infrastructure to release that product, figuring out things like what's the return policy and stuff like that is occupying most of my days leading up to it. There's a lot of little details to button down.
Oh, I can't wait until
the,
you show
the fun stuff. Right?
Yeah. That's the business people stuff, right?
It's actually really lovely, right? Because I am an avid consumer, and so I really get to put my money where my mouth is in terms of the customer experience that I value and how I'm going to give that to the people that are going to purchase a product from me.
You need to go back to Twitter and look through the whole history of things you've bitched about companies doing to you, and you got to make sure you don't do any of them because somebody's going to find out if you do.
Exactly. That's so cool. Yeah.
The thing you showed me a prototype of the thing that you built, and it is absolutely gorgeous. I can't wait until more people get to see it. That's rad.
Well, I mean, you know, one of my folks asked me, "What's our privacy policy?" And I was like, "Oh my God, right. I get to actually write out a paragraph about the fact that if you give me your email address and you say you want to hear updates, that is all that you will ever get from me. And nothing else will ever happen. Not in bankruptcy, not dissolution of my company will ever let me yield that email address to anyone else for any other reason." And I love that I get to write that paragraph.
If you get taken to North Korea and people are pulling out your fingernails, are you going to give up these email addresses, Adam?
Nope, never.
That's what we like to hear.
Full stop.
That's good. That's rad.
And it's an opt-in system, not an opt-out system, too.
Beautiful. Beautiful. How do you feel about arbitration?
No, I'm not going to bully people into arbitration.
Okay, that's good. That's good.
No.
So you are traveling, Adam. You started a tour a couple days ago. We're later in the week now, but this past weekend we hung a little bit. We went down to Prop Store.
Yes.
Ooh.
That was really, really fun. I have never been. I know Brandon and Stephen Lane from Prop Store very well, but I have never been to one of their warehouses, and that was absolutely thrilling.
It's their new warehouse, and I hadn't been to it either, but it's a massive space. It really feels like the ending of Indiana Jones and the warehouse everything gets crated into, because it's really high ceilings, it's endless, and every crate is filled with these treasures.
Yeah, it's totally incredible. And not just treasures, but it's like, it's rare that you walk into a warehouse and you can recognize most of the things in it, even though you've never been there.
Was it like going into the Indiana Jones warehouse, the one at the end of Raiders where they put the Ark and it's just like a bunch of crates on the walls, or is everything out where you can see it?
It's a little bit of both. Everything's labeled. There's a ton of, you know, they had racks and racks and racks and racks of costumes. So you're looking at the costumes, you're realizing that, you know, every single piece in here was the result of a complex series of meetings between a studio and a director and a production team and a prop warehouse and a costume warehouse. And I mean, each little tiny piece you see in this warehouse is the apex of a pyramid of creativity.
And the people who work there are kind of like archaeologists, because they have to dig through the histories that no one has recorded, because they often just get things literally in crates from studios with not a lot of information.
Yeah, absolutely. They have to figure out where that piece was used. A lot of this information gets lost in the translation from production, from the mayhem of production to the afterworld of what this piece was and where it got used and who was wearing it.
So they really just get a giant box full of stuff from the studio at the end of the production. Like they don't. Do they buy that stuff in lots? I guess.
I think they have different relationships with different studios. They have, I think it's always different for them. Realize that every single film is in and of itself its own company to a certain extent. And thus, every single film has its own corporate culture. And I think that Prop Store has to navigate that on a studio by studio and sometimes film by film and sometimes director by director basis.
Cool. Hey, can we jump track a little bit here? Trying to find I don't want to make a lot of noise typing, but there was a really interesting thread on Twitter yesterday about Justice League. Did you see this, Norm? Mm-hmm.
What's going on?
So one of the reviewers came out and I think he made a statement that was kind of misinterpreted by people who work at ILM and other places. But basically, he said, look, this movie, they should have held it until 2018 because the VFX are rough and you can't blame that on the directors. That's kind of the VFX supervisors. And I think it was interpreted to mean, hey, this is not the director's fault, when what he meant was, hey, the director had a schedule to make and they had to decide, you know, that they have to ship this movie when the $1 billion marketing campaign behind it hits. Look at the decision not to hold the film as the cause of the sloppy VFX work in Justice League. If I haven't seen it yet, so I mean, I'm reiterating this reviewer. And then a bunch of people from the effects industry came in and were like, look, including directors came in and said, look, ultimately at the end of the day, the director is the person in charge of this giant moving, this assemblage of moving pieces, and you get, like, it's on them. The buck stops with the director at the end of the day. And as somebody who's worked on the VFX side, I'm kind of curious, like, what you think about that. If you think that that's fair, or you know, I'm rambling a little bit, but I think it was interesting because, like, you had somebody making a statement, and the directors were coming in and saying, "Hey, you're wrong. We're actually the ones responsible," which is unusual for Twitter and modern discourse.
That is, I, in my experience in the special effects industry, it goes back and forth. I have heard stories of producers deciding to render effects at a lower resolution than the director desired in order to meet delivery deadlines and cost deadlines. I have certainly heard that story repeatedly. Battles between studios and directors over the overall quality of how that rendering happens.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah.
Go ahead, Norm.
No, I completely agree that, I mean, it's, we try to think of films as purely art pieces and collaborative pieces between creative people, but it's also collaboration between the business people too, and that's the producers and their jobs is to keep it on schedule, on budget, and those are, you know, the constraints of money and time are very real things for any type of creative endeavor.
Yeah. Also, this is a film where they had a ton of reshoots. They brought in Joss Whedon after Zack Snyder had to leave. And I'm quite positive that the demands on production were exorbitant, that because of Whedon coming in and doing a bunch of reshoots and all this stuff had to be integrated with what they already shot, that there must have been a tremendous amount of people working very hard to get this to meet the deadline.
Oh, no doubt. And a movie like this, there's thousands or tens of thousands of effect shots, yeah, right? With, like, exactly, probably six or seven companies all working on different bits and pieces. You know, if it's like the Marvel movies, then you look at the VFX reel at the end of that, and there's a half dozen companies at least on any one of those films. So it's a big undertaking.
You know, Dig had that classic link that they usually do for big blockbusters like this, which is the what are the reviews overall saying about Justice League? And I clicked on it because I tend to like that aggregate that they do. But on my mobile phone, I could not get past whatever pop-up ad they had. It would show up and just take over the whole screen, and there was no way to get rid of it or scroll past it without signing up for some bullshit ref, so I just was like, nah, never mind, see you later.
Can we talk about what grinds my gears, Adam?
Do it.
Let's when you scroll on a web page and they have those ads that window pane down and then window pane back up, But if it doesn't work right on your mobile, then it just makes the whole page jump up and down and is unreadable. I just turn the page off. I'm never going to go back there again. The website's dead to me.
Yep. They can bite me. Yeah. I can't stand that. Drives me absolutely insane.
Pits.
Well,
sorry.
Specifically with Justice League and speaking about aggregates, you know, obviously Rotten Tomatoes is the aggregate that most people go to look at reviews. And they did something different this year for Justice League. They held their page and they held their tomato meter score because they wanted to announce and unveil the score because it's so important now, I guess.
Oh, boy.
With like a web show they were debuting last night.
Ooh.
How'd that go for Justice League? Pretty good, right?
Not well.
Okay.
And it's not like anyone else. It's not like you can't find the reviews yourself. If you bookmark, you know, all of your reviewers' favorite movie pages, you could make your own aggregate. But we rely so much on this Rotten Tomatoes score. I think we hold it to such high importance. I know there's a lot of talk between studios about how important that score is, and I think studies have shown that it actually doesn't really correlate to how well a movie does. There are movies that review very well and don't do well financially.
It didn't correlate for Blade Runner one bit.
Blade Runner has an 87% and made not much money, sadly.
Right.
It's done okay internationally, which I'm pleased about. But, I mean, the saddest thing for me about Blade Runner's ticket sales receipts not matching its Rotten Tomatoes score is that means that no one's going to try and make that movie again, or it's going to be a long time before a studio takes that kind of gamble. And we need more weird, hard R, thinky science fiction. We're just better if we have, you know, more than just bubblegum science fiction, right?
They should have put the Incredible Hulk in it. That would have brought people to the seats.
How great was Thor Ragnarok? Have you guys seen it yet?
I haven't seen it yet. I'm going today. Oh, I'm the worst. We'll talk about it next week. Can we talk about it next week? Okay.
We'll talk about it next week.
I also want to point out,
for sure,
that I've been totally silent about this. I've been totally silent about this, but the new Mythbusters aired last night on the Science Channel. And I feel like it's incumbent upon me to mention that. I met Brian and John at New York's Comic-Con. That was the second time I met them. I met them on the set of the search for the new Mythbusters back when that first started. They're delightful guys. And I'm only bringing it up to say I wish that I haven't watched it yet. I plan to today, but I wish them every success. And I love reading the Twitter response seems to be very positive. They were working with a lot of my old Mythbuster crew. And so it makes me very, very, and my heart is full with the idea that those two guys get to host that show. I hope they get to host it for years and enjoy it as much as I did.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So cool.
And I believe people they've put up the first act of the show on their Facebook page, the Mythbusters Facebook page. So if you don't have Science Channel, you can still watch a good chunk of that show online.
Oh, that's cool. Very cool.
The future. Hey, guys, I got fiber into the house. It's so fast. It's so good.
Really?
Oh my God, it's the best. Norm, you didn't tell me. You've had this for ages. It's so nice.
It's amazing. Yeah.
Everything uploads really fast. Everything downloads really fast.
I know we'll talk about the Hulk next week, but I mean not the Hulk, the Thor Ragnarok next week. But another movie that is coming out next week that I did get this chance to see, and you saw this already, Adam, is Coco. I saw Coco this past weekend.
Oh,
and
awesome! Tell me what you thought.
I don't want to spoil anything, and I shouldn't.
Yeah.
But it sticks the landing so hard that even thinking about the ending makes me choke up a little bit.
Yep, exactly.
So
and
good.
Here's the thing I also really loved is that the movie sets up some premises, and you think they're going to lead in a certain direction, and you're like, oh, I think I figured this movie out. And then it confounds most of your expectations and gives you something so much better.
Oh, that's so good. That's kind of my... Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
I was just going to say, it's also now the highest grossing film that was ever released in Mexico.
Take that,
and
Avengers.
On Twitter, I'm seeing tons of responses from people from Mexico saying that it talks deeply to the culture and the history of Mexico and Dia de Muertos. It's just I love that they you know, for a big studio to do a film that is that culturally specific is a gamble. And it speaks well of Disney and Pixar to have tried it. And of course, at Pixar, everything's about story. And this story is magnificent.
And I don't think that should push people who aren't part of that culture away from the film either. I think that was definitely a concern. Like, if I don't specifically relate to the aspect of that culture, which they treated very well and showed off beautifully. I think one of the things that Pixar does well with all of their films, whether it's, you know, Brave or even, you know, things like Good Dinosaur, which wasn't so well received, is that they have universal themes that everyone can relate to. And it's surprising how often they come up with new universal themes of the human experience, of the familial experience. So it's not just, you know, the same Finding Nemo father-son theme over and over again.
Yeah, exactly. And that universality of the family theme. Coco is deeply about family and specifically from a Mexican cultural perspective, which is unique. It's different than ours. And that's as it should be. That's what culture is. It's the way different peoples encompass and encounter and interpret the world. And Coco gives you a brand new vantage point on that. And that's really wonderful.
Can I take my five-year-old?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
Unequivocally, go right ahead.
Awesome. I mean, look, after they made me care about a robot that there was no spoken word for the first 45 minutes of the film, I'm kind of in for whatever they do, but this sounds pretty good.
Norm, I am sending you to post on this podcast, I'm sending you a picture of some fan art I was given yesterday. I had two different fans give me some amazing things. One was a painting of Excalibur on a Field Notes wallet.
Wow.
Oh, that's awesome.
And the other was a painting of me as a panda cosplaying as Chewbacca with C-3PO on my back.
What was the reason behind that?
This woman is an amazing painter, and she her name is, hold on, her name is Diana Teeter. And she paints animals cosplaying. That's one of her things. And she paints these beautiful paintings. And she gave me some stickers of other paintings of hers, but she gave me this original painting of Panda cosplaying as Chewbacca with 3PO on his back. And it's going right in my house. This is a beautiful piece.
That's so good. That is so good.
I just sent it to you, Norm, so we can post it.
Yeah, we'll definitely share that. Absolutely.
Hey, absolutely.
I also saw, I know we have to go momentarily, but I saw that you posted the video of your tour of the Museum of Moving Picture, the Henson exhibition there.
Yeah.
And we talked about it a little bit a few weeks ago. I just wanted to plug that again because I haven't watched the video yet, but everybody that I know that's been there has said it's incredible. And I wondered if you had any more thoughts about it.
So people should know it's a permanent exhibition, and it is an intimate one. It is in I don't like to say it's in a small space because it doesn't feel like it's in a small space. Architecturally, it's put in just a few rooms, but narratively, it really moves you through Henson's incredible creativity and deep history in a way that I found super moving. There's a point at which you turn around and see a classic Muppet, and I caught my breath at seeing Rolf. I realized he's one of my all-time favorite Muppets, and maybe the only Muppet without any kind of neuroses.
Rolf's scene in the Muppet movie with Steve, where Steve Martin in the restaurant, is my favorite Muppet scene ever. He's just so soulful. Rolf is the most human of the Muppets, I think.
I totally agree.
People should be surprised by their own reactions because, you know, as much as you might love characters from Sesame Street or the Muppets or even things like Dark Crystal, I don't think the reaction that you feel is, you can realize that until you're in that moment walking into the room and make eye contact with those puppets. There's a deep connection there that brings something out of you that's difficult to explain.
I think I saw a traveling exhibition of stuff at maybe Disney World at MGM 15, 20 years ago. And just seeing Kermit and seeing Fozzie and seeing Gonzo and like realizing that these are not just these things that live in my head and live on the screen, but are real things that somebody's hand was inside and that somebody, a human, was driving, and seeing how they work. You know, a lot of times seeing how things work takes a little bit of the magic away for me. Like, the behind the actor studio of the Simpsons cast kind of messed up the Simpsons for me for a long time because I couldn't not see Nancy Cartwright and Hank Azaria and Harry Shearer when I was hearing those voices. But this made it better.
So I'll tell you something that Dave Goles told me. Dave Goles, the Muppeteer who has performed Gonzo since the beginning, and also Dr. Bunsen Honeydew and all sorts of amazing characters. First of all, I got to see Dave Goles as Gonzo sing. I'm going to go back there someday to Michael Giacchino at his birthday party in England.
God.
The most amazing thing about that is as soon as Gonzo goes on Dave's hand, Gonzo's there. It's not Dave performing Gonzo. It's Gonzo. And then Dave told me about performing Gonzo for a bunch of school kids at one point. And after he left, apparently, the teacher said, just after he finished the performance, the teacher said, let's give a hand to Dave. And the students were like, who's Dave? They like barely even registered that there was a person underneath the puppet. They just engage. And you do. It is. Those puppeteers are such masters at character and storytelling that as soon as the puppet goes on their hand, you just forget that there's a person behind it.
Well, so at the museum exhibition, do they show how the, like, do they show cross sections of the puppets or anything that's truly like, cause they're relatively simple puppets, right? Like compared to, yeah, like Jabba the Hutt, who's a incredibly complex puppet.
They're very simple.
The puppets are disassembled, but they are diagrams, and the apparati that the puppeteers use are often on display right next to the puppets. So from the headbands to the monitors to the rigs. Yeah.
Cool.
Totally worth visiting. Cool. The other thing I want to give a shout out to that's on the site this week is our final video from Adam, your visit to the Blade Runner set, where you are honorary stuntman in the second biggest water tank in Europe. It was truly astounding to see those waves crash
it
into
really
you.
It really was. A million gallons, and the dive crew for Blade Runner was super awesome, super professional. They were fabulous about putting me in their rig and letting me receive the full force of it. Afterwards, they gave me a dive crew t-shirt. They made me an honorary member of their crew. They welcomed me like family.
That's awesome. That's so cool. Well, I guess that's it for us today. Norm, anything on the site this week you want to plug?
Those are the things. Also, some stuff from DesignerCon, but we can talk about that next week. I did have a nice chat with our friend Jason Freeney, artist, sculptor, toy maker. So that will be on the site this weekend. But have a good week of touring, Adam, and we will check with you next week.
I will. I had some fans at the meet and greet last night who were sad that Still Untitled didn't go up that morning, and I promised them it would go up today.
Fulfilling promises, even on the road.
Yes, exactly. I'll see you guys next week.
Have a good tour. See you soon, Adam.
All right.
All right. Bye, guys.
Bye.